On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the days of Richard Nixon's imperial presidency and the epic Watergate scandal, John Dean was Nixon's White House counsel at the right hand of a president whose abuse of power led to disgrace and resignation. Now, John Dean is charging that his old boss, Richard Nixon's abuse of power, was peanuts compared to the executive power grab he sees underway in the Bush-Cheney White House. Today's GOP leadership charges Dean in a hot new book is downright and dangerously authoritarian, leaving far behind traditional conservative restraint in the exercise of government power. Leaving behind, charges Dean, American democracy and the U.S. Constitution. Up next on Point, John Dean raises the alarm on authoritarianism in the USA. Joining me now in the studio is John Dean, former White House counsel to President Richard Nixon from 1970 to 1973 and star witness and convicted player in the White House prosecution. His new book is Conservatives Without Conscience. John Dean, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Big charges you're making here. Authoritarianism as opposed to American democracy on the loose in the Bush-Cheney White House, and you say today's GOP. What's your charge? What's your case?
Well, what happened is this book really emanated from conversations I had with the late Senator Barry Goldwater back in 1994, where he was mystified and miffed at what was happening with conservatism. I was mystified and confused about what was happening. And he said, John, let's try to find out the answers. What was troubling him were things like the nastiness that had come into it, the incivility. He thought a lot of the charges they were making about Bill and Hillary Clinton very early in the Clinton presidency, long before the Lewinsky matter came up, were just absurd. He was distressed by the religious right's influence on the Republican ranks. And he said, you know, I don't understand this. I'd like to get the answers. Unfortunately, his health didn't hold out, but we did launch the project. I titled the book based on the conversations we had together, and he actually suggested the title that these were conservatives without conscience, at least as he understood the conservative conscience. And I did find the answers. The answers are that there is a segment within the conservative movement today that is dominated by authoritarian personalities.
Authoritarian personalities, and you describe that as being translated into policy. I mean, you're very tough here. You're using language that we do not hear a lot of. You're talking about proto-fascism. You're raising the names Mussolini and Perón and Hitler. You're talking about authoritarianism taking the country off its traditional political path in a very profound way. You say Nixon, who you worked for, Nixon, for all his faults, had more of a conscience than Bush and Cheney. You say it's not fascism, but it could get on that road.
There's a lot in what you just said. Let me peel a few of those apart.
Please.
Let me take the Nixon matter, for example, why I say he has a greater conscience. I can't imagine Richard Nixon in his darkest hour, darkest moment ever tolerating torture as a part of the policy of the United States in dealing with anybody, no matter how bad and evil he might have considered them. Here's a man who came out of World War II. He knew the repercussions that torture could have on troops. I saw how he handled My Lai. I can't envision him tolerating his vice president going to the Senate and lobbying for torture. I can't imagine him threatening to veto a prohibition against torture. So that's why I say there's a different type of conscience in play today.
Proto-fascism, like, that's pretty strong phrasing.
Authoritarianism by its nature is proto-fascist. I don't say that we are there. I don't say we're on the road to fascism. Fact of the contrary, I spent a lot of time with a lot of experts and read a lot of works in this field, a lot of political scientists who have studied and are concerned about whether it could ever happen here.
But it would not take much more misguided authoritarian leadership or thoughtless following of such leaders to find ourselves there.
Absolutely, and I believe that, and that's one of the reasons I did the book. We are not that far away. It is what I think most of the experts believe is that the authoritarianism will be very different when it comes to the United States. It won't be with goose steps and high-heeled boots and what have you. Rather, it'll be with a smile, and we'll subtly give up our rights and liberties just an increment at a time, and we'll find ourselves on the other side.
You've tried to go to the root of this thing, to make a kind of scientific study of the authoritarian personality, both on the leader side and then on the followership side. What did you learn in that?
Well, what happened is, in looking for answers to the questions the senator and I had in our minds, I couldn't find them at first. It took me a good while to find them, and I found them in this body of study that's about 50 years in the works. It started actually in the aftermath of World War II, that studies the authoritarian personality. And there, the more I got into it, the more I realized this explained the conduct of a lot of people I knew very well and what had watched up close and was aware of the kind of thinking they engaged in. Now, you're right. Authoritarianism breaks down into two categories. The bulk of authoritarian personalities are followers. There are people who are easily submissive to the authority of their choice. They are very aggressive in pursuing the policies of that authority. They're very conventional when that's the accepted standard of the authority.
We don't think of that as the American character.
It is.
Don't tread on me, and liberty and independence are the phrases that we're raised with.
There are a lot of Americans, maybe in the Massachusetts and Boston area, you don't think of it, which I would agree. You probably would find fewer authoritarians here than other places, but there are an awful lot of people who, particularly post 9/11, where the ranks of authoritarianism increased, who find safety and security being authoritarian followers. Now, the dominators and the leaders are somebody, they're a group that have been really studied most in the last 10 years. They're people who are dominating. They're people who don't believe in equality. They're people who are amoral. They have very little inclination as to following the rules when they try to get ahead and get in leadership positions.
And you, John Dean, are not afraid to name names here. You're doing it right throughout the book. Who are you putting in that category?
I have never been shy about naming names. While I'm always reluctant and was concerned about using typologies, the more I got into this, I realized, and the more I talked to some of the experts in the field, that clearly these labels apply to a number of people. And I, for example, think there's no question that probably our leading authoritarian is Dick Cheney. Lesser to agree, George Bush. But I look at people in the Senate, Bill Frist, Newt Gingrich, Tom DeLay. The people the publisher put on the cover of the book they're really textbook examples of authoritarian personalities.
It's a very broad brush here, but you say these are conservatives without conscience who are capable of plunging this nation into disasters the likes of which we have never known. Why? What?
Well, I'm not sure which is more frightening in my mind, the next escalated terrorist attack, which will inevitably come, or how the authoritarians will deal with it. And that's where I think we have to have our antenna up and quivering.
Is 9/11 the reason for this, or is this something predating 9/11?
It predates 9/11. In fact, one of the leading researchers actually started studying it during Watergate when he noticed how many people stayed so loyal to Richard Nixon so long, notwithstanding the information they were learning. And actually, that's when he wrote his first book on the subject to alert people to this potential.
And what's the gap between traditional conservatism and what you describe as this authoritarian conservatism? What's the sort of wandering away from the root here?
Tom, I found that many conservatives don't really understand conservatism, and liberals and moderates even less. So what I tried to do is compress a great deal of information about conservatism to show how there are some weak foundational points in conservatism that made it very easy for the authoritarians to recast it in their own image, if you will. And this happened when the religious right really made a grand influx into the conservative ranks. They're very authoritarian by nature and their fundamental beliefs. The evangelicals are sort of structured in a hierarchical manner. And as they've come in and dominated the Republican ranks, they have, along with neoconservatives, I must add, which are not necessarily they're not authoritarian personalities, but they have authoritarian policies. And those two combined have really, in my estimation, pushed conservatism into a totally new mold.
How loud is your alarm bell, John Dean? Do you really think America can wander off its traditional democratic path, into some whole new authoritarian realm? Isn't this a self-correcting system at some level?
Well, we certainly hope so. Obviously, there are roughly 23% of the American people, based on the best data I've been able to find, that are solidly authoritarian conservatives. There are about 10%, 12% that are on the 180 degrees, on the liberal end. Most of Americans reside in the middle. They're centrist, and we've operated best as a centrist country. But the ranks of authoritarian conservatism are growing by leaps and bounds. And the terrorist attack resulted in more people joining these ranks. Another terror attack could push more. So I thought somebody's got to get this up on the table for discussion so we realize what we're doing and don't do it foolishly, carelessly, and mistakenly.
Mark is calling from Boxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Mark?
I think John Dean is absolutely right, and I think furthermore that you can trace this development back to the time when Republicans married the idea of political conservatism to the personal conservative values of the religious right. And I just want to give you a quote from Teddy Roosevelt, a former Republican president, and to show you how far the party has veered. He said in 1908 that if there's one thing this country stands for, it's complete religious freedom, and it's an emphatic negation of this right to cross-examine a man and his religion before being willing to support him for office. Now, can you imagine a Republican running for office today that wasn't not only willing but anxious to talk about his religious beliefs? I blame the party for embracing that. I think it's a fundamentally un-American posture, but I also blame the media for running with it. The media has come so far from those days when JFK had to go around the country trying to persuade people that his religion would not dictate what he did in office to the present day when all politicians are expected to wear their religion on their sleeve and expound on it at length.
Mark, we'll look at that with John Dean, but let me also just ask you, how does it strike you to hear this critique coming from Richard Nixon's White House counsel, of all people?
Well, I've been paying attention to John Dean for many years. I watched him testify before Congress. I thought you did the country a great service then. I think you've been doing the country a great service ever since.
John Dean,
here's a
round of applause from Mark. He looks at the connection to the religious litmus test in a way as central to the dynamic you're describing.
No question, that is a huge factor. In fact, probably the greatest impact of the religious right is while they're unable to get a candidate themselves, they can't get a Pat Robertson elected president, they can't get a James Dobson. They are the filter through which most people at go into both state and national politics have to pass at the local level. They've been very effective on the ground. They're very active in organizations at the primary level. So if you don't pass their litmus test, as we now see a number of national candidates start trying to move and cater to their wishes and move to their direction a little bit, they really have control of the agenda as a result of that.
But why would that lead to or be linked to an authoritarian profile in power?
Because they are authoritarian in their thinking, in their nature. And it's only these charges are not something that I make. These are things that come up in empirical testing where people who have taken hundreds, literally, there are thousands of individuals who've taken these tests, tens of thousands.
These are sort of personality tests that show leanings toward what?
Well, they're tests that try to uncover these types of traits in people, and they find this is what conservatives are saying about themselves. The religious follower is typically an authoritarian personality.
Suzanne's calling from Houston, Texas. Hi, Suzanne, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have two questions for Mr. Dean. The first one, and I do appreciate you writing this book, and I plan on reading it. The first one, I'd like you to compare Karl Rove to G. Gordon Liddy, because I see many comparisons there. And also the second, I'm very outraged, actually, about the monetary ties of Dick Cheney to the Iraqi war and how he's making so much profit off of this, yet it's not really brought up that often.
Let me just ask you, G. Gordon Liddy and Karl Rove, supposed to be a political genius, G. Gordon Liddy was kind of the, you know, the dirty work guy. Aren't they at the opposite ends of the spectrum?
No, not at all. I see them as very closely similar, and actually I am a clinical psychologist. I do appreciate this authoritarian take on this. I see Karl Rove, because I followed him in Texas politics for years, as very antisocial. He puts up a large front as a very religious man. I don't know how he's had 9 kids working the hours he's had, but at the same time, you know, he's the kind of guy that will drink the Kool-Aid for anybody, and I firmly believe that he had something to do with the Valerie Plame incident, and I think that if it was a male CIA agent, something would have happened much more seriously, much more quickly. But I think that they're very, very similar, and I would not put it past them to have a radio show 20 years from now where people are just, you know, totally engulfed, you know, just very amazed by every word he says.
Suzanne, let us pick it up, and thanks for your call from Houston. John Dean, well, here's a loaded name in your universe, G. Gordon Liddy. You and he have fought in the courts for years. You sued him over all kinds of stuff.
And
Suzanne
and
says, and won. Suzanne says, let's look at G. Gordon Liddy and Karl Rove.
Well, the big difference, there is a true difference, and one is that I think Rove is much smarter than Liddy. Liddy isn't stupid, but can you imagine going into a burglary with 7 men like an army? Can you imagine the way the trail these people left all over the country when they were out recruiting? It took about 5 hours for them to find out for the FBI after they got caught who was involved and why they were involved. Karl Rove is very smart. He's always set himself up so he has deniability. He has his cells that operate on their own, if you will. And I think the men are, I think Rove is much cleverer than Liddy. Probably learned from Liddy's mistakes.
So a very smart guy. Are you presenting all of this as a knowing move toward authoritarian government, or is this just personality? Are these people, do they really believe they're still within the fold of the American Constitution and simply interpret it differently than you do?
These people do not think of themselves in terms of authoritarianism. This is a word they don't know, they're not familiar with, it's not been in the debate. That's one of the reasons I've got it up on the table. You occasionally see a reference to it, not very often. They certainly don't have the kind of data that I've gathered and pulled together for them. So most authoritarians don't want to hear any criticism. They don't want to, they're not self-critical. They're highly self-righteous in their pursuit of their goals. So that particular group is not going to change. A few of them, sometimes when they realize the nature of their behavior, will, but we have to live with them because they're that way, and I think we should understand them and what we're living with.
But are you charging that they are knowingly anti-democratic?
Charge is a heavy word.
I don't know what else to call them here.
These, to me, are certainly, they're not pejorative, they're descriptive, and they're not charges. They're, to me, a fair analysis based on raw facts.
This question stands. Is this a knowing anti-democratic movement, or is it simply a kind of a character that leans toward stronger leadership?
It depends upon at what level. With the followers, I don't think it's knowing. With the leaders, I think they know exactly what they're doing, and no one will be more patriotic. No one will wrap themselves in the Constitution more, but no one will push the envelope further in their own pursuit of their zeal. I don't think these are evil people, understand. They're zealous people, and zeal is often a problem, particularly at the leadership level.
Alice is calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Alice, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to say to Mr. Dean that my daughter and I are students of Watergate, and we agree with the title of your previous book, that this is definitely worse than Watergate. My question is about the idea that Barry Wirth writes about in the book 31 Days, that Cheney and Rumsfeld's views of executive power were formed in those 31 days between when Gerald Ford took office and Nixon's pardon, and that Cheney always saw Watergate not as a criminal conspiracy, but as a struggle between the legislative and executive branches.
Yeah, I've not read the book, 31 Days. I'm very familiar with it. I hope to read it. I just have been busy with other things. I'm familiar with the period also, and I think there's no question that Cheney had some sort of trauma during that time, that he came into office after 2000 with a very clear agenda of expanding presidential powers. He was sitting there as Gerald Ford's chief of staff when the Congress took apart the imperial presidency, and he never got over it. And so they had this agenda before 9/11. They have used 9/11 to expand the so-called imperial presidency way beyond. I think they found an old Nixon playbook down in the basement, and they brought it up and dusted it off and said, this stuff looks pretty good. Let's see if we can add a few chapters.
Are you at all sympathetic to what Cheney and Rumsfeld glimpsed in that Nixon-Ford kind of interregnum there? I mean, Cheney clearly, as you described it anyway, decided, you know, you can't really count on Congress. When the chips are down, you've got to have a strong presidency. Do you have sympathy with that at any level?
Well, I do. There's no question that there are needs for a strong executive. But that isn't the imperial presidency. It goes way beyond. That abuses power. That's unilateral government. That's an attitude which Nixon acknowledges in his memoirs, where he laid down the gauntlet and tried to push the Congress around way beyond his powers. That's exactly what's happening again. Cheney, who has swallowed this presidency, who has more power than any vice president's ever had, is doing what Nixon would have done on steroids. He's really pumped up the presidency.
What's the goal? You described the danger as a kind of Caesar in the White House. Do you put that kind of extreme characterization around Dick Cheney's view? Is that what the vice president would...
I do. I don't think Cheney's, as I say, I don't think Cheney is evil. I think he is misguided. He's one of the few people in North America who doesn't think the president had the inherent powers even post-Watergate to do what was needed. And, you know, the way they're pushing it, everything from signing statements.
This is where the president makes his own interpretation of what Congress means by legislation.
Which the Boston Globe did a good job of bringing to public attention. But to the littler things, just the way they handle daily life, we could talk for two programs and not even begin to cover what they're doing to expand presidential power. They're doing executive orders where they're rewriting laws. They're going to walk out of there with their executive papers, their presidential papers, contrary to the law.
Sealed, with those not open.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Is it hypocritical, John Dean, for you, White House counsel to Richard Nixon, in that run-up to the Watergate scandal, to be pointing fingers? I mean, you were there at Nixon's right hand.
I happen to be one who pointed out a lot of these things internally in the Nixon years. I'm one who tried to tell him as to what he should and should not do with his papers, how he should make them public, how they should be available for the public. I'm one who actually, during the height of Watergate, told him he was in a heap of trouble and went in and told him there was a cancer on his presidency, hoping he would end that cover-up. There's no question that I decided to cooperate with Congress because I thought that was the only body that could deal with the problem, and not either a special prosecutor or the normal process of the U.S. Attorney's Office.
And what about, I'm sure someone on the right will say, this is just John Dean looking for vengeance. There was a reinterpretation of Watergate that was raised years later, linked you and your wife, that you disputed this in the courts, and one I know, but linked it to an entirely different interpretation of what went on there, talked about a prostitution ring in Washington. Is this a bitter John Dean seeking revenge through describing Republicans as new dictators?
It's neither bitter nor partisan. The partisan juices went out a long time ago. I'm registered as an independent. If a partisan for anything, it's good government. What I'm trying to do is I'm somebody who understands how it works inside. I have inside knowledge. I still have very good contacts within the Bush and Cheney administration, people who are telling me their discomfort with what's going on, and I'm in a position where I can assimilate this information and seem to be able to write it so people can read it. And people seem to appreciate what I'm doing. So that's why I've continued to do it.
Johnny's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Johnny. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Good. Quickly, I'd like to make two points, if I may. One, and as a student of American history, I have always said that America tends more toward fascism than democracy. And cite two examples quickly. One, is it the genocide perpetrated against the native peoples of America, and two, the treatment of black people in America always tend, in my mind, to to exhibit fascism rather than democracy. And secondly, this current group of people who are in the White House have demonstrated one of what I think are the strong traits of authoritarianism, and that is personal cowardice. Bush, Cheney, Pearl, Wolfowitz, all never have stood for America. That is, when they had the opportunity to be in America's armed forces and defend America, they all chose a different place to go. And to me, it just strikes as hypocrisy as well as authoritarianism.
Johnny, if you see, that's a pretty radical interpretation of American history. I mean, we understand what the cases you're citing, but if you see the U.S. as traditionally, your word, fascistic, then is there something new going on here or not?
No, this is the American tradition. I mean, I've always listened to people talk about the great American experiment in democracy, and I've always shaken my head and said, wonder which America they refer to, because, for example, the great person, the Republican Party likes to point out Ronald Reagan as being this great whatever. You may recall that when he began his campaign for presidency, where did he go first? He went to Philadelphia, not Pennsylvania, but Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
The symbolism there is too great to overlook. How could you possibly go to the place where Cheney, Goodman, and Swerner were murdered to begin your campaign, except if you wanted to give that message rather than going to Philadelphia and Pennsylvania.
Johnny, let us pick it up. John Dean here is a radical skeptic on the whole American project, says there's nothing new here. This is what the country is.
Well, actually, I was able to trace back and do in the book authoritarianism and conservatism back to the days of Edmund Burke, where traditional conservatives find their earliest sources. And writing at the same time is a French nobleman by the name of Joseph de Maistre. And if you track him up through Alexander Hamilton and on into American history, you really see this authoritarian conservatism as a presence up until about the presidency of Andrew Jackson. And it's after that it seems to dissipate and hasn't returned until roughly the early 80s and 90s in American government. So there was, and I don't know the reason it stopped and started again, other than the religious right coming back in and being an influence, but I don't have the full answer. But the caller is correct about the early history. It stops, and then it has now started back in spades, and that's one of the reasons I think it's of concern.
Jay is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
It seems like it's really simple in that everyone, if they've had a parent, like a father who's authoritarian, or a boss, if you've ever had a boss who's authoritarian, you recognize this type. And sometimes you might shudder and think, thank God my boss isn't President of the United States. And now we have a whole cadre of them. They're talking about having a permanent Republican majority and dealing with the apathy of the American public on even the rights they have and they take for granted. It seems like it's ripe for a continuation and for it to get worse.
So you don't see a natural pendulum swing coming here, Jay?
Well, I think that the balances that were in place in terms of the balance and dialogue, the balance of power, have tipped to one side to the point that you can't get that balance back. If Republicans are talking about a permanent Republican majority and you fill those Republican upper ranks with these type of authoritarian figures, it'll be a long time until the rest of the American public, as apathetic as they are towards the political process, to realize that many of their liberties they took for granted are gone.
Of course, Democrats had a majority for a long, long time, and that ultimately changed. I want to invite one more voice into this conversation, if I may. Joining us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Bruce Fronin. He's co-editor of American Conservatism and Encyclopedia. He's professor of law at Ave Maria School of Law, author of Virtue and the Promise of Conservatism. We talked with Bruce Fronin a few weeks ago when the new Encyclopedia of American Conservatism came out, got some of his perspective then. He's been good enough to listen in today. I wanted to get some of his perspective on John Dean's charges here. Bruce Fronin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You expressed some of your own concerns when we talked about the direction conservatism is taking. So is John Dean's alarm too great for you, or are you hearing something you're sympathetic to?
Well, it's unfortunate, really, because I think the problems that he's pointing to are very real. We've got a great deal of political centralization going on now. I agree with him on most of his policy problems. Unfortunately, that he has fallen into a trap here, which is that of referring to people you disagree with as being somehow sick. The whole paradigm of personality is really very problematic, because you can give these surveys and define people in ways that really don't reflect reality. And I think what it really comes down to is a kind of irrational fear of religion. And I think the problem is it takes us away from the real issues, which have to do with political centralization, all the fear that we're all dealing with.
And you say don't get into all the personality profiling here. That's not the heart of it, but yet there is a drift that you described for us a few weeks ago. But you're saying what? It's intellectual. It's conscious. It's not baked in the personality.
It's not baked in the personality. It has much more to do with wider trends that, frankly, Democrats have had as much to do with as Republicans have. Mr. Dean's very worried about evangelical conservatives in particular, calling them authoritarian. Well, evangelical conservatives have the most dissentious form of religion I know of. There's no hierarchy that they deal with. And they came into national politics when the courts in particular nationalized issues of church and state, issues of abortion. Right, these are issues that used to be state and local.
John Dean, Bruce Fronin says, you're wrong to go to the personality here. That's not where the action is. And you've got an irrational fear of religion going on in your interpretation of authoritarianism.
Well, first, let me thank him for his encyclopedia. I wish he'd completed it a little bit earlier than I could have used it in my book, and it would have saved me some time digging out some of this material. So nice job, well done, important contribution. As far as I have no personal fear of religion. In fact, I'm a religious person. The material that I developed, you haven't hardly had a chance to see the book yet, and you'll see what happens is this is material I found sitting out there and talked to an awful lot of experts about, and these are things that conservatives are saying about themselves, not things I'm saying about them. It's not things social scientists are saying about them. It's things that are revealed in repetitive testing over a long period of time, and it's self-disclosing. So these aren't pejorative or efforts to label people or put them in boxes and classify them. This is an explanation that comes through from their own anonymous testing.
Well, they might be seen as Bruce Fronin, and he's pushing back. Bruce, are you concerned? Do you think authoritarianism itself is too strong a word for the trend we're seeing in political leadership in the country today?
I think there are some real dangers to some very important liberties, some of the policies that are going on. But to try to paint this as a particular group of people who are aiming at furthering their own powers as the sole source, I think, keeps us away from looking at the real systemic problems.
What's your sense, then, of why this drift, which you agree there's a drift toward more centralized power, why do you think it's underway, then, if you don't go for John Dean's sense of certain sort of personality types drawn to it?
People are looking too much to Washington to solve their problems, and not enough to their own neighborhoods, their own towns, their own states. If people want the central government to solve all their problems, they're going to have to give the central government the power to solve that. And that means an imperial presidency. There's no two ways around it. There's no way around it.
I'm not quite sure how one separates personality from anything anybody does in any venture of life, whether it be politics, whether it be economics, whether it be just everything. I think we're influenced by personality. The hope in raising this is not to label anybody. It's to indeed encourage to look at the problem, to see indeed the degree of it, because I don't think that anyone wants to head down what is the dangerous road of authoritarianism. And if we look at it and quantify it and qualify it and properly discuss it, then the danger is going to lessen. That's the drill here. And I must tell you, Bruce, I actually sent this to a couple of very hard right-wing, well-known conservative friends of mine who I asked, give it to me straight. And one of them said, John, you know, a lot of conservatives aren't going to be happy with this, particularly the authoritarians, but I think it's important you've done this to get the debate. Another one said to me, it's about time we get the A word, authoritarianism, up on the table and start discussing it because it's a truism.
Bruce Fernan, within conservative ranks, do you see a movement to push back against this tendency of other quote-unquote conservatives?
Yeah, there's a real battle that's brewing that has not been covered as much as I might have thought. There's a lot of opposition to this war. There's a lot of opposition to what's going on through Homeland Security, the various ways of getting around the need for warrants to tap people's lines and all the things that, you know, John Dean has done a good job of pointing out here. There's an awful lot of conservatives who are very upset about this.
So a different interpretation of the root, but maybe some related pushback. Bruce Fernan, co-editor of American Conservatism and Encyclopedia, thanks very much for being with us from Ann Arbor today.
Thank you.
Joe's calling from Boston. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a very liberal Democrat, and I don't think that authoritarianism is really unique to extreme conservatives. I see it as well in my very liberal friends. And I think it might be just a liability for any group in power. They did a study in the 60s, I can't quote who did it, but where they studied conservative CEOs and leaders of the kind of hippie counterculture movement. And in terms of authoritarianism, they were almost identical. So that I think it's a sort of human liability, not unique to conservatives. I see it a lot in liberal Democrats. And it may be the climate of fear that increases the likelihood of authoritarians. I think all political commitments are more a function of psychological dynamics than reasoned intellectual commitment.
Joe, thanks for your call. John Dean, you talk about, you write about Hitler and Mussolini. What about Mao and Stalin?
Well, it's interesting that the testing shows that there is very little right-wing authoritarianism on the left. And this is repeated. Yes,
by definition, it wouldn't be right-wing if it were on the left, right?
Well, that's right. They're convinced that that it's out there. If you did the same test in, say, communist Russia, you would find people who would be left-wing authoritarians, if you used that label, or you could also call them right-wing authoritarians because they would support communism and the perpetuation of communism.
But Joe says it's not about the right. It's about maybe fear and
What happens, that's true. Fear is a factor. But the other thing that happens repeatedly in these tests is people come out and say, what are your politics? They're conservative.
And that's the majority, so that's where ownership has to lie here?
That is the overwhelming majority, not just occasionally. This is like 90% of the results show this.
And yet you've got conservatives like Bruce Fernan saying, this isn't my cup of tea at all. No, thank you.
Well,
that's not what it means to be conservative.
He's not had a chance to look at the book. He's not had a chance to see these studies.
No, I'm saying his cup of tea is not centralized power.
No, and typically that is not a conservative position. Centralized power.
And yet he would call it the old, exactly, he'd be right on the same page with you there. John's calling from Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just wondering, and it has to do with the comments made by Mr. Froning, what happened to the movement by Christine Todd Whitman, who was trying to take the GOP back and move it more towards the center?
Yeah, where does that? Have you followed that, John Dean? Christine Todd Whitman on that?
I have indeed. She's what they call in the conservative ranks and in the conservative Republican Party a rhino. She's Republican in name only, and unfortunately, she opened a web page and then never filled in the blanks. So I don't know why she lost enthusiasm for it, but it didn't go anywhere. And I'm sure that the conservatives within the party did everything to discourage it.
Michael's calling from Rhinebeck, Iowa. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for writing the book, and thanks for having the show. I have a question about something you said earlier in the show about the spectrum of American culture, where you placed about 23% as authoritarian conservatives, and I think maybe you said 15% as hardcore liberals. Where do you place the growing, among the young, and it's I know it's small, but anarchist, libertarian, socialist tendencies? You see there's a backlash to big business and growing fascist government colluding.
What I was saying is that roughly 23% of the American people are really sort of hardcore authoritarian conservatives. Actually, there are many more than that. The numbers are very large. When you start really seeing who would follow Bush and Cheney anywhere, it comes down to about 23%. There are others who are attracted to their brand of conservatism and who are have certainly leanings. I'm talking about those who score very high on the testing that develops these type of personalities.
Carl's calling from Boston. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to relate a story. I was studying under a professor who was born and raised in Nazi Germany, and he remembers when all the stuff started to go down and he had to flee. And I was over his house after 9/11 having dinner, and he asked me what I thought about the situation, and I told him, and I was, you know, all patriotic at the time and things like that, and he told me how the blind patriotism of the citizens of the United States was actually scary to him because that reminded him of growing up in that time in Germany, and he was nervous at that point, 2 weeks after 9/11, that the government could abuse the citizens' feelings towards blind patriotism right there and just use it for wrong. And
So an unwelcome deja vu there. John Dean, you use these potent names, Hitler, Mussolini, and right on down the line here. What kind of parallel are you suggesting here?
Well, when you read those, of course, in the narrative, I'm using them as examples. They are I'm not painting anybody who is an authoritarian conservative as being a Mussolini or a Hitler or anything of the nature. I'm just I don't know which particular reference you're referring to there. I don't think we have anybody who is that extreme. We have people who do test high. We have people in leadership positions who do test high. And I think they're leading the country in a very unhealthy direction.
Give us your sort of checklist of evidence of that. You're talking about the White House. You say the White House is structured as a kind of Cosa Nostra, and you extend that right into Congress.
I think I said they may have taken consultants from the best and the brightest of the Cosa Nostra at one point.
Their White House as La Cosa Nostra might have recommended.
Right. And they have. And there's just no question they have developed deniability. They have surrounded themselves immediately with people who will fall on the sword. It has been the most secretive White House we've ever had. It pales by the Nixon secrecy levels. They are blatant in it. They run a very tough, tight shop. This is, as I say, this isn't traditional transparency of democracy. So that's why I used a line like that to make the point.
So describe the fork in the road then. What steps would take us further down the path you fear? What steps might take us away from that?
I think knowledge is the answer. I think if people realize where we're going, as I said, there's a small percentage that's not going to change in their ways, but there are many more who will not follow that approach if they have knowledge of what they're doing. So that's why one writes a book like this.
And Richard Nixon, if he could look out on this presidency today, would it look familiar to him? Would it look strange?
I think it would look very strange to him. I think it's gone way beyond what he would think appropriate even. I talked to somebody the other day who said, you know, we could run Richard Nixon as a green today.
On the environmental issue.
But
in terms of presidential power, I mean, he was a man.
There are bumper stickers saying out today saying Nixon doesn't look as bad as he used to. Because, you know, indeed, he was. I'm looking at what's happening in the headlines today in the Middle East. Nixon, I think, would have been over there or had Henry over there trying to prevent that. The escalation. How do you deal with the problem of Hezbollah? Do you have to, you know, try to wipe them off the face of the map, or is there some control? Can they be somehow sanctioned, isolated, instead of a war that we don't know where it's going right now? And this is not a Nixonian-style foreign policy. In fact, what's remarkable is how irrelevant the United States become in what's going on over there.
So your final warning here to the American people, as you see it, about where things are headed?
Knowledge. That's always the secret. And as several callers mentioned, apathy is, of course, always the problem. And so hopefully people don't have to have the highway go through their front yard before they get interested.
John Dean, author of the new book, Conservatives Without Conscience, former White House legal counsel to President Richard Nixon. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.